Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here, and I am chatting with Mariquita. And we are going to talk about some kind of lesser known women in history for Women's History Month. So I am going to let Mariquita start. You've got something that I am wholly unfamiliar with, and I'm very excited about it.
I'm glad you're excited. So I'm Mariquita, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Mexican Revolution. I know, very contemporary historical reference. I think, you know, something that actually does have a lot of threads that run through to today and contains a lot of stories that we just don't hear about. So to set a little bit of the landscape for you, the Mexican Revolution took place roughly between 1910 and 1919. And it's considered one of the first social revolutions in Mexico. It was in response to President Porfirio Diaz's policies, which you might be shocked to learn really benefited the wealthier classes.
Wow, never heard that one.
Never heard it from a person in power. And it benefited foreign interests too, which was kind of a big deal. There was a labor strike down there that resulted in 20 people dying because of a clash between Mexican labor interests and an American company. There were usurpation of indigenous lands due to a series of agrarian laws. Couldn't happen here.
No, never heard that one either.
Yeah. And a denial of citizenship and agency for women. Women were literally not considered citizens at that time. Three main revolutionary figures came out of that. There was Pancho Villa, who was born by my family's home in Mexico, in San Juan del Rio. And there was Emiliano Zapata, who was the peasant reform guy. And there was Suniano Carranza, and he was a constitutionalist. So that's the basic landscape of what we're looking at. So to talk about the soldaderas, or las adelitas, as they're sometimes called, there's not an official definition of soldadera in a Spanish dictionary, in a dictionary that contains Spanish colloquialisms. The definition itself is kind of disputed, but it's largely accepted to refer to women who worked for the revolution in various capacities and roles, and is sometimes disparaging. Another shocker from the patriarchy. Women joined the revolution for a variety of reasons. They followed their husbands, lovers, male family members. When I was first researching this, I will be honest with you, my immediate reaction to that was one of sort of derision. And I needed to check that in myself because that's definitely not fair. And I shouldn't discount the contributions just because it falls under the role of like traditional work for women. They were paid for their work. A lot of times this is something that kept them and their families alive in an otherwise really harsh environment. And their role was super critical to the success of the revolution. Plus, my feeling about it kind of plays into the script that the government created after the revolution to emphasize the work of these soldaderas to discredit or undermine the women who had active combat roles. They recast these women as women who just followed their men around from camp to camp and catered to their needs, which is super inaccurate. And it casts female laborers unskilled and unworthy. And also, just as an aside, not all the soldaderas identified as women, but I'll get to that. Awesome. I am often referring to them as women or using she pronouns because that is how you'll find them referred to in the text. And I want to be consistent, not because I'm trying to erase the work that was done by other people. There were absolutely women that were compelled into the war effort against their will and with significant violence or threat of violence. They deserve much more attention than I can give them. War is fraught with unspeakable horrors. I know I'm not telling you anything you didn't already know, and I'm not glossing over it. By all accounts, hundreds of thousands of Mexican women were casualties of the revolution, and the vast majority of those women were impoverished, rural, indigenous, and urban poor. Their story needs and deserves to be told unquestionably, but very, very, very little info is available about them. If someone wants to pay me to research it, I am taking offers. The night is young. I am not credentialed to research it, but I'm happy to do it because somebody needs to do it.
So you're telling me that the 20 minutes that, you know, Feminist Book Club is compensating you to do this podcast is not enough? I don't understand.
That brings us finally to Las Adelitas, which is what I really wanted to talk to you about. There are two terms for these fighters. There was the soldaderas and the adelitas, which is another fun trick of the patriarchy. So the government minimized the role of women in combat by emphasizing the more domestic labor of some of the soldaderas, like I said. But the second prong of that attack was to cast the folks that chose to fight as like sex pots, you know?
Awesome, of course.
Yes. Yep. Beauty over bravery. Think Salma Hayek and Penelope Cruz and Bandidas, but 1910 style. And the image was super, like very much about very, very light skinned pinup women in low cut peasant tops. There's a place for that, but.
The revolution, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what? It's the same as like the Tomb Raider theory where you're just like, I wouldn't be fighting in like a negligee. I
bet they had their hair pulled back. That's the one thing that pisses me off yeah. about like action movies is the women never have their hair in ponytails. Like, come
you're
on.
You're gonna. But as an accomplice to this rebranding, there were these corridos or ballads that would extol the irresistible beauty and charm of these adelitas. But here's the thing with derogatory language pinned on exceptional people. Language itself is constantly in a state of evolution anyway, and I really want to talk about language sometimes, so just hold on to your hats. But it gets reclaimed. And the Chicanx movement of the 1970s saw that appellation and they were happy to repurpose it. So now the term Adelita indicates a fierce, liberated badass who will fight for her rights and the rights of others and owns her sexuality. You know?
Right. And if she looks hot doing it, well, so be it.
Hell yeah. Take that, old dead Mexican federal government officials. That's one of my favorite parts of the story. It's just the bravery of people to step out of that societal norm and that expectation and put themselves and their lives on the line to fight for their rights and for the rights of other, you know, because they were not wealthy. Most of the women that fought in this revolution were not wealthy, to try to recast them as just irresistible, you know, helpless, docile. Come on.
Because they can't have power otherwise, you know? The only way that they can have power over men is through their sexuality. That's the only thing that's like remotely acceptable.
Well, and it also sort of conflates them with prostitutes. And they also try to do that with the soldaderas that were like the camp followers. At that time in Mexico, prostitutes were some of the most liberated women because they weren't under constant control of men. But most of the soldaderas were indigenous, mestiza, or Afro-Mexicans. And that's another thing people like to dismiss is Afro-Mexicans. Shocker, there are Black people that live in Mexico, okay? There are Black Mexicans. We need to really embrace that heritage too because those women did a ton of work. The very existence of the soldaderas defied social norms and the ideas of femininity just by leaving the home and not being in the custody of a male figure. Women at this time were always in the custody of a male figure, a father, a brother, a husband, an uncle, or if they joined the convent, but Catholic Church. They weren't pious. Speaking of the Catholic Church, many of them were anti-cleric and saw the Catholic Church as just another tool of oppression. Most of the soldaderas had low-level rankings, but they rose up. And at a time that women were actually allowed in combat roles in the U.S., so that garnered a ton of foreign press. Some of them had obnoxious headlines like girl soldiers, but there were also articles about 500 soldaderas on the battlefield. Not much, unfortunately, is known about soldaderas anymore, despite their tremendous contribution. The patriarchy disinformation campaign is utter garbage, but was very effective. But there are some soldaderas with some quantity of information available. The first two took on male identities, but went back to female identities. There was Petra Herrera. She went by Pedro. She fought under Pancho Villa. She rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel. Pancho Villa hated soldaderas. There's conflicting information, but it seems like he stripped her of her rank when her identity was revealed. But she continued to lead brigades of soldaderas, sometimes around 400 at a time. And then there was Angela Jimenez, who went by Angel. She joined the revolution to avenge her sister's death.
Cool.
She was not as successful at pretending to be a man. She tried to tell people that she shaved in the morning before anybody woke up. But my favorite is Emilio Robles, and I'm referring to Emilio with the male name that he chose. He was born Amelia, but took on male identity very early, maintained male identity throughout his life, was recognized as a man by family, by friends, by the government. He's believed to be one of the first transgender figures in Latin American history, and the only documented case of gender transition in that part of the world. I still would like to make a call to any Mexican writers, any Chicanx people who want to write historical fiction on any of these amazing people. Please do it. Please do it. I would love to read it. I know I'm just one person, and a one person doesn't a profit make, but like I would love it. But anyway, our time is finite, and there were just a couple more people I wanted to get to.
All right, let's hear them.
Okay. So the wealthier women and women with access to pursue education and training opportunities and were of note unfettered by marriage played a different but also like equally important part in the revolution. And when I was reading this, I fell in love with two of them, Juana Belén Gutiérrez de Mendoza and Dolores Jiménez y Muro. And both were fierce fighters for social justice, and both were subject to imprisonment because of their actions in fighting the federal government. Gutiérrez de Mendoza would write grim but honest depictions of reality, but she would counter them by cautioning her readers against despairing and instead push them to participate in the electoral process. Side note, women didn't gain suffrage in Mexico until, can you guess when?
Oh, I want to say like the 60s.
1953, yeah.
Oh, shit, yeah. I knew it had to be real disappointing.
You're right. But she pushed them to participate in the electoral process, not to integrate power, but to disintegrate it and rebuild a truly public administration, which I love.
Yes.
And then Jiménez y Muro was an avowed socialist who crafted this political and social plan as part of a overthrow plot, by the way, which argued for agrarian reform. In this case, that means a return of stolen lands to indigenous people, and or reparations for stolen land, improved wages and working conditions, educational reform, indigenous protections, pay equity among the sexes and among the racial groups, and affordable and safe housing. Wildly radical ideas.
Give power to women. Give political power to women.
What's unfortunate is that all these efforts weren't very successful, actually, in making a significant difference for women in Mexico for a while. But they were a catalyst, and they propelled the women's rights movement forward really significantly. They did gain citizenship in the Constitution of 1917. They gained some rights from that, but there were no enforcing bodies. But they remain a point of pride for me. Like, I'm so proud to have that as part of my heritage.
Yeah, these are your ancestors.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So who did you want to talk about?
First, I was thinking about my favorite poet, Dorothy Parker, who is like the original hot mess. And I'm honestly obsessed Dorothy with Parker. Her. She's funnier than she had any right to be. She loved fast men and hard liquor. And I think she is too famous for this segment because I wanted this to be somebody that's like not as well known. Mm-hmm. Then I thought about Sibella Nitti, who was one of the murderesses of Chicago. And her story inspired the musical Chicago. My friend Emily LeBeau Lucchese wrote a book on her called Ugly Prey. It is excellent. She was called an ugly and poor immigrant. She was an Italian American, seen as kind of subhuman by the press. Then her lawyers gave her this glamorous makeover, and ultimately her charges were all dropped.
Ooh.
And that inspired, you know, the Foxy Roxy Hart, like all the other Mary murderesses took note of her, you know, her makeover and drop charges. But then I was like, even though I wanted like complicated women that we may not exactly want to celebrate during Women's History Month, Sabella didn't hit for me yet. And so, So then I thought about Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first woman in the United States to receive a medical degree. But what's interesting about her was this was during the first wave of feminism, during suffrage movement. She was anti-suffrage. And so I thought that was very interesting. And she was anti-suffrage because she thought that women should hold some sort of power or be able to contribute to society before they exercise the vote. Otherwise, they're just going to vote alongside whatever their husband's vote is. Which, I mean, I kind of think, I'm not saying she's right, she's not. But there are some points when somebody goes so far to the left, they're right. they're like conservative again. And that was one of those moments where I was like, I get what you're going for, Dr. Blackwell, but it doesn't sit right for me. So ultimately, I landed on Florence Howe, who is considered to many to be the mother of women's studies. She was the founder of the Feminist Press. And so for this audience, for this purpose, it felt like she's not all that complicated, even though I wanted a complicated woman. She's pretty straightforward and wonderful. And I thought our audience is gonna, you know, dig learning about a feminist publishing maven, one of our earliest kind of godmothers. So Florence Howe was born in Brooklyn in 1929. She got her bachelor's in English in 1950 from Hunter College, and her master's from Smith College, which is a women's college and still is a women's college, and went to grad school at the University of Wisconsin. But after she left University of Wisconsin, she taught in Mississippi Freedom Schools in the 60s. So I wasn't familiar with Freedom Schools, so I looked up what those were. And she was a white woman, but Freedom Schools were temporary, alternative, and free schools for African Americans, mostly in the South. And they were part of the civil rights movement to organize African Americans to achieve social, political equality in the US. So as a white woman, she from the Northeast, she goes down to Mississippi and starts to teach in these schools. But I think what is so interesting is she starts to formulate this theory of social movements in education and starts to see kind of how education can be a path to liberation, but also can hold people back through indoctrination. Mm-hmm. So I found this article she wrote in 1965, which I will link. And she says this, and I thought this, I wrote this all down because I thought it was so good. As educators, we live in a fool's paradise, or worse, in a knave's, if we are unaware that when we are teaching something to anyone, we are also teaching everything to that same anyone. When we say we're teaching mathematics to Freddie, we must also admit that we're teaching Freddie the kind of person we are, how we live in this world that we control, or the kind of world that controls us, and how we can grow up to be one of the controlled or controllers. The Freedom School teacher is, in fact, to be present, not simply to teach, but rather to learn with the students. And then she goes on, does a little bit of a case study, and she says, the teacher's main problem was to learn to keep quiet, to learn how to listen, and to question creatively rather than talk at the students. So what she's doing is she's seeing how these Freedom Schools are really putting into practice kind of this co-creation of knowledge and this co-teaching, this interplay between students and teacher and kind of the breakdown of hierarchy in the classroom. And she uses that to question what constitutes education. And it inspires her ultimately to consider how then gender is also reflected in education. Like I said, is it holding women back through indoctrination, or is it a path to liberation? I think it's so important to recognize that so much of what we understand as women's studies now and women's education now is influenced by these freedom schools and Black folks in the South teaching one another and kind of coming up with their own systems of education. She's only there for a year or two. She goes back to the Northeast. She lands in Baltimore and starts teaching at Goucher, which is a women's college in Baltimore. So she goes to teach English at this women's college. Her students didn't want to read literature about or by women.
Cool. That's so cool.
Because they assumed that in order to feel really educated with like a capital E, they had to study men. They had to study the canon. But Florence Howe was not here for this shit.
Yeah.
So she writes about this in later articles that, you know, women in higher ed, the case for putting women, getting women into higher ed early on was, like you said, like the domestic roles, like so they could learn how to teach and caretake and blah. Then the next kind of phase of women in higher ed was for women to learn men's curriculum. Anything you can do, I can do, right? I can also read fucking Freud and shit. But Florence Howe basically asked, like, what if we applied the same rigor of study to Freud and Keats and Shakespeare, but we do it through the lens of women's roles in history and philosophy, in sociology and anthropology, like shift the gaze of the entire academy. And instead of centering the white man, what happens when we center women and marginalized people? Because she was intersectional in her feminism from the beginning, even when that wasn't a thing. So step one, gain access to the institution. Step two, play the rules of the institution. Step three, burn the institution down and build it back fundamentally different was basically like her ultimate goal. So women's studies is essentially born from this experience, from that conversation with students that they don't want, that they have to read men in order to feel educated. So that's like the first half of her career, is she's establishing the field of women's studies, of which I am a student. And I just like, I owe my education to this woman. I didn't know anything about her. And she gives this definition of women's studies. The teaching of women's studies has several goals: to raise the consciousness of students about sexism in the curriculum and in the wider society, to compensate for the omission of women in the curriculum, to encourage research, and to recover the loss or neglected history and culture of women. In like the second half of her career, she's a book reviewer for The Nation, for the New York Review of Books, like back when you could get paid to review books, like that's what she did.
Oh my God, I can't, I just like, I'm dreaming now. I would love that.
But she wanted to create the series of like mini biographies about women writers, and The New York Review of Books was like, nah. And so her husband at the time actually said, like, why don't you just create your own publishing house? And she was like, nah, I'm going to see if somebody else wants to do that.
To be fair, it sounds like a lot of work.
So she takes this idea of a feminist press to the Baltimore Women's Liberation Group. Word got out about this idea, and some feminists newsletters picked up the announcement of the feminist press, which wasn't an announcement at all. It was literally just like, hey, you guys want to do this? And they were like, nah, sis, maybe later. But then these newsletters were like, just kidding. Like, guess what has just been established in Baltimore? And so Florence Howe was like, guess what I'm doing now? It's the feminist press. Small checks began arriving in the mail, and I think before their first meeting, they already had $100 of just like people, women, like sending in $5 here and there, which is very cool. It was like micro lending. So she decides that she wants to do this, and puts out a call, like, if you're interested in helping me out, come to my house. And she thought like maybe 10 people would show up. 50 women showed up at her house one night.
Oh my gosh.
All but one identified themselves as a mom or housewife, and they established the feminist press. So one of the announcements in one of the newsletters said that the feminist press would publish biographies and poetry and children's books. And Florence Howe was like, hold up, I never said children's books. What is this crap? But one of the women that were at the meetings was like, hey, I've never seen a kid's book with a woman doctor at the center, and that's what I want to publish. And so Florence Howe was like, ugh, okay. So actually the feminist press first book that they published was a children's book called The Dragon and the Doctor by Barbara Danish. I will say this is kind of dicey. It was inspired by, or more likely plagiarized from, a Chinese book that featured a woman doctor and a boy nurse who, like, I think fixed up a teddy bear or something. And Florence Howe said something like, oh, the Chinese won't mind. They're a sharing people. And that was very cringy.
Yeah.
But the second edition that came out in the late 90s does include a family with two moms. So at least there's that.
I appreciate, here's your complicated woman.
Exactly. This is where the complication shows up. It's like, oh, I feel like you stole some intellectual property there, man. It kicked off what is now kind of the germinal fundamental publishing house for women and marginalized genders. So the specialty of the feminist press becomes reprints of works of then little known writers. So think The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, one of my favorites. So it had been out of print for decades, and the feminist press made it one of its first reprints. Another book that you may have heard of that is a feminist press book is All Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave, Black Women's Studies from 1982, edited by Gloria Hall, Patricia Bell Scott, and Barbara Smith. Florence Howe also edited what was, I think, the first anthology of women's poetry. Title doesn't hold up right now. The title of this anthology was No More Masks.
Oh boy. No, you need to, I mean, she wouldn't have known.
No. This is 1973. But still, I was just like, oh, that doesn't sit right. And the Feminist Press is the publisher of Women's Studies Quarterly, which was an academic journal I used a ton in grad school. The Feminist Press still exists. They publish about a dozen books a year from all kinds of genres, cutting edge fiction, activist nonfiction, literature and translation, memoirs, still children's books. A couple that came out recently that may be familiar to our audience. We had Ivelisse Rodriguez on the podcast early on. Her short story collection, Love War Stories, was a feminist press book, as was Fiebre Tropical by Juli Delgado Lopera, which I think is a bilingual novel. So that's very cool. They're doing some really interesting.
Yeah, sorry to talk over you.
No, please. I don't know anything about it.
I read it this summer.
Yeah.
And it is sort of bilingual. I wanted to clarify, there's not a lot of context, right, for what she says in Spanish, but it was a great story and I would really recommend it.
It's a nonprofit publishing house. They've got one of the first queer imprints. They've got the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize, which highlights debut books by women and non-binary writers of color. So they're doing really cutting edge publishing and sharing really unique stories with the world. She passed away in 2020 at the age of 91. Talk about these just long, full lives of these people. From complications from Parkinson's, but she was affiliated with the Feminist Press as, you know, executive director emeritus and professor emeritus at Hunter College still, I think, until she died. So I just thought she was fascinating. And I didn't realize how much of my own, like, academic career I owe to Florence Howe.
You know, I was thinking when I was doing the reading on this, how many really important, influential women there are in history that we just don't really ever hear about. And Florence Howe, that's not even really history. It is, but not, you know, it's contemporary history.
Yeah.
You know, we could do this every day for years and not come close to scratching the surface.
And there are podcasts that do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't need to be that.
But I think it's really cool that I suggested we do something about lesser known women in history. You came to the table with something really personal and important to you. And I stumbled across this just wealth of information about this incredible woman that I had not have learned about otherwise. And hers is the candle that I feel like that's what I'm kind of carrying. Hers is the torch that I'm kind of carrying into the future too.
She built a lot of the foundation that we rest on without us being aware of it.
Right, exactly. So that was Florence Howe. I will link some of her work in the show notes, as well as some of the Feminist Press books of that we mentioned and all of your sources too. So Mariquita, where can people find you online if they want to ask you about the book that they're writing about Las Adelitas?
Well, caveat, I'm not a publisher. They can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray. And I'm not there super, super often, but I am trying to be better about it. And I did just post a picture of the cookbooks that I recommended with Natalia. So if folks haven't listened to that episode, they should.
It is excellent and excellent cookbook recommendations. I'm a little salty that I wasn't invited to the discussion of cookbooks, but I understand. It was the conversation wasn't for me, so I understand. But I do have a large cookbook collection.
I have 23. I counted them. It's too many, probably.
Well, you can find me on Instagram. I handle the Feminist Book Club Box Instagram. But if you want to creep on my dog and the food I eat, I'm over on Instagram at Belle Renee, BelleRenee. Thank you so much for hanging out with me.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.